It's so good to be with you this morning. You know, I started telling people that I was giving the first talk, the breakfast talk. I got a lot of condolences. Most people would rather, you know, wake up a little bit before they have to come up to a podium. But I was a little bit relieved because that means that I don't have to have a tough act to follow. And unless you think that that's some false humility, many, many times I've had to follow the best pro-life speaker in the world, my father, Joe Scheidler, on the podium. And that can be pretty tough. I remember one time in Northern Ireland, we were up there at the Stormont, which is their parliament building, and we were supporting a united effort. All the parties of Northern Ireland had come together to oppose abortion in the effort to try to force the abortion law of the United Kingdom, of which Northern Ireland is part, onto Northern Ireland for reasons that are too complex for me to understand. You know, British law is confusing. Abortion is legal in the United Kingdom, but somehow not in Northern Ireland. They have some element of home rule. So we were there supporting the effort to keep it that way. And my dad got up, and I had been noticing all these umbrellas going up and down. I thought, this could be a good kind of opening joke. But then he stole it from me. He said, you know, I'm from Chicago, and we get rain in Chicago. It's a windy city. You know, it'll rain sometimes even two or three times a day. But it rained 17 times while we were waiting to come up and give this talk, and all the umbrellas are coming up and down. And so he stole my joke and stole my thunder, and I had to follow him at that presentation there. And that's happened any number of times. So I'm glad he's not here today, too, thankfully, to speak before me. So I'm glad to have the opportunity to open up the speaking for this conference. I was also really glad to see the bishop here because I'm a Byzantine Rite Catholic as well. And in the Byzantine liturgy at my parish, St. George Church in Aurora, Illinois, one of the elements of every single liturgy is for us to chant the Beatitudes. So they really get into your skin. And as a pro-life activist, you can imagine that I've drawn some parallels between the things that our Lord says in the Beatitudes and my work. You know, blessed are you when you are reviled and persecuted, that kind of thing. And in fact, I have an experience of having been reviled and persecuted that I want to tell you about today. It's about 3 years ago, April 15th, 2015, I was arrested at Chicago's Navy Pier, one of the most popular tourist attractions in the city of Chicago, in fact, in the whole Midwest. There's a big Ferris wheel there. In fact, the very first Ferris wheel ever was put up by Ferris himself in Chicago for the Columbian Exposition. So it's Ferris Wheel Town. And they're tearing down the Ferris wheel at Navy Pier and putting an even bigger Ferris wheel in. They always want to have the biggest Ferris wheel in the world there. There's a Shakespeare theater and all kinds of IMAX and all kinds of restaurants. Very popular place. And we were there to protest Planned Parenthood's, they call it their Generations Gala. Can you think about that? Every year, Planned Parenthood has a big fundraiser called Generations. This is an organization that's dedicated to destroying generation after generation. At one of these events, I shot a little video about the generations theme, because I got to thinking about it. Planned Parenthood is now aborting their third generation of unborn babies. The first generation to be aborted by Planned Parenthood, their very first abortion was in 1971 in New York City, in the spring of New York of 71. Abortion had been legalized in New York a little earlier. And that would have been a member of my generation, Generation X. I was born in 66. I'm Generation X, right, the beginning of Generation X. So they went all the way on through aborting babies of Generation X to the point where one out of every three of us was aborted as you got into the late 80s. Then they started to abort the millennial generation. It's a generation that some of my children belong to. I've got eight kids. The oldest is 26 this summer, so he's one of those millennials. And then this next generation, I'm not even sure it has a name yet. Some call it Generation Z or Generation Me. I don't know. I hope it doesn't turn out to be that one. They'll come up with something. That generation is now being aborted by Planned Parenthood. And they're doing the abortions on members of the Silent Generation, then the Baby Boom Generation. Now it's Gen X parents that are still having abortions, and some of those older millennial kids are having abortions. So generation after generation. So we were protesting Planned Parenthood at Navy Pier during their generation's celebration. And I decided after our signs were set up, we had signs alerting people to who Planned Parenthood was, how they lie to you, you know, who's here. We had pictures of abortion victims so that people would see exactly what Planned Parenthood is about, so that the donors and benefactors of Planned Parenthood would have to see exactly what their dollars are going to. So we'd set up, and I decided to walk onto the pier. I was very hungry. We'd had a very busy day that day, a meeting that lasted all day. We thought we'd have time to get a bite to eat on our way out to the pier. We didn't. I needed the lavatory. So I decided to walk onto the pier. I wanted to see if people were talking about what we were doing, if it was creating any buzz, and kind of see where Planned Parenthood's event was taking place. So as I walked towards the pier, there was a security guard there. And the security guard told me, "Stop, you're not allowed to go on the pier." I said, "Why not? I see people, why aren't you stopping everybody? I see people walking dogs onto the pier, riding their bikes, doing whatever, going to get a bite to eat." He said, "You're at the protest, right?" I said, "Yeah." "Well, you can't go on the pier." I said, "Well, I can't go on the pier because I'm pro-life. I'm not protesting right now." He said, "No, you can't go on the pier if you're not pro-life." So I stepped back a little bit. I had this GoPro camera. Just started using these, and I wanted to make sure I got them in the picture. So I stepped back. I don't wanted to get this on tape. This guy denying me the opportunity to go into this public place just because I was pro-life. And I think that kind of tripped something in his mind. He thought, "Well, you know, I don't want to get caught on video telling somebody they can't do something." So he said, "You know what, let me check it out with my supervisor." So he radios the supervisor and says, "Hey, you know, can the people from the protest, you know, go on the pier at all for, you know, the bathroom or whatever?" And the voice over the line said, "Yeah, they can go on as long as they go one by one and they don't carry a sign." And then he just waved at me. He says, "Well, you heard it." He waved me on. I said, "Hey, thanks a lot for checking. I really appreciate that." You know, I was pushing back at the guy, but we had a cordial interaction. And I said, "Thanks." And I walked on by. I had still a pro-life thing on. I had my Choose Life cap on. But I thought, you know what? Let's not even have that to cause any trouble. So I took the cap off, put it in my pocket. Walked into the pier. Now, it's a long pier. It's an actual naval pier. It used to be, you know, where naval ships, the United States Navy, would dock. It's about a mile long almost. And the interior is very nice, all these restaurants and things. So I started walking along down the pier and, you know, listening to see if anybody was talking about the photos that they'd seen or the protest or the Planned Parenthood event. And gradually I got past the crowds where there weren't really very many people yet anymore. And I saw a sign for Planned Parenthood's Generation Celebration. Took a little picture of that, you know, just so I would have a record of where I was, what I was doing. And yeah, I carried on walking. And I saw a bathroom. And, you know, I decided, that darn GoPro camera, I think I'll wait. I didn't want to turn it on or off because it was new and I wasn't sure I'd make a mistake. So I just left the camera running and left my bladder the way it was. Kept on walking. I finally get to the very, very end of the pier, right before the grand ballroom. And I turn the corner and immediately a woman with a clipboard comes up to me and says, "Are you here for the event?" I said, "No." She said, "This is... area's closed for a private event." And I just walked right on past her to the doors. There were a couple security guards at the doors, and I asked them if there was a sidewalk out there that I could use to walk back down the pier. I hear the woman kind of walking behind me, click, clack, with her high-heeled shoes. Well, that's funny. Why is she following me? You know, I was not comfortable. The security guards pointed me the way to go. I went outside. Now I'm at the end of this pier. It's a beautiful day, chilly but sunny. And I started walking along Lake Michigan, one of my favorite bodies of water. I grew up on Lake Michigan, biking up and down Lake Michigan. I used to bike along Navy Pier. I remember going to see, this is going to really age me. I mean, I've already told you I'm 51, but David Cassidy, the singer, Sean Cassidy, remember those guys? Weren't they from the Partridge Family? Well, one of them came and did a concert at an event called Chicago Fest that we used to hold way, way back in the 19th century at some time, you know, the 70s, I guess. And, you know, I remember I had this very embarrassing hobby. I told somebody about this for the first, my wife didn't even know this till just the other day. I used to collect unicorn pins. That's right. I had all these unicorn pins in high school. I used to buy them at Chicago Fest. I know that's kind of an embarrassing hobby for a boy. Anyway, even weirder is that my brother Joe had collected some of my pictures of unicorns that I used to draw, and he still has one, like in his bedroom. So I guess we're kind of a weird family. So as I'm getting to the edge of the pier, right by the water, walking along the sidewalk, I look back and I see this same woman, this Planned Parenthood woman, talking to security guards and gesticulating and stuff. What's going on here? I mean, I'm leaving, you know? So I'm walking down the pier, and a security van starts tearing towards me with its lights flashing. This isn't good. So what's going to happen next? The van passes me. That's a relief. All right, so I'm walking. Again, this is a mile-long walk just about. So I'm walking down the pier. And I turn behind me, and I see that security van is turned around at the end of the pier and is now tailing me. Just tailing me as I walk along. Oh, goodness. So trying to convince myself that all was well, I stopped and I took a couple of selfie photos with my iPhone. Just kind of, here I am at the lakefront. I think they thought I was taking a picture of them. It kind of looked like I was, but I wasn't. They tried to subpoena me for the photos of their van later, which didn't exist. So I'm walking down the pier. I finally get to the end of the pier. By this time, I am incredibly nervous, and I cannot wait to be on Chicago public property. Now, Navy Pier is kind of a funny public-private space. We found this all out later when the lawsuit started. It's public property, but it's leased to a private, not-for-profit corporation for $1 a year called Navy Pier Incorporated. Navy Pier Incorporated is, in turn, I guess, licensed by the MPEA, the Metropolitan Pier and Exposition Authority. There's also an entity called SMG that is responsible for training the employees. And this is what our government does. They create these layers upon layers upon layers of private and semi-private and semi-public organizations so as to seize public space from us. How many times are we out there with our abortion victim photos or our signs protesting an event or just doing public education when some security guard tells us this building owns the sidewalk? My first thought is that can't possibly be true. Quit telling me lies. But then we find out it is true. There's buildings all over Chicago, all over major cities, that own the sidewalk that the public uses out in front because of these kinds of diabolical arrangements that are seizing public land, public space, space for First Amendment expression from us, the people. And that happened at Navy Pier in Chicago as well. And I knew this. I knew that this was a kind of a quasi-public space, and I wanted to get to the unequivocally public Chicago park land because there I knew I would be safe. Right as I get to the end of the pier, the security guard comes up to me and says, sir, can I see your ID? And I said, no, you may not see my ID. First of all, because I didn't want to have to be stopped. Second of all, because I know once you hand your ID to an officer, they own you. What are you going to do? You need to get your ID back. You need your ID. This came home to me in a very real way yesterday when I got off the plane, was walking towards the airport shuttle to the hotel and realized I didn't have my wallet. And now I'm thinking, what do you do when you lose your wallet and you're out of town and you need it to get back on a plane the next day? Texted my wife, got the prayers started. St. Anthony, Our Lady came through. They had my wallet at the gate. All is well. So, you know, I hold on to that thing. You don't want to lose your ID. Plus, he was a security guard. He has no business asking for my ID. Second of all, even if he were a cop, even if he were the chief of police, he would have no right to ask for my ID. So he starts following me now. I've got the van following me. I've got the security guard following me. There's another security guard coming this way. Then I see a Chicago cop, and my heart rises. Chicago cops, these guys have serious problems to deal with. They're not going to be worried about a little pro-life activist who's walking around Navy Pier in public space causing no trouble. We deal with the Chicago police all the time. I'm always glad to see them because they're a bit gruff. I wouldn't say they're friendly. I mean, the friendliest of them kind of just grunt at you. And then they point at their, like, you know, Jesus pin or something. There's a lot of really good Chicago cops out there. But they're all really gruff. So I thought, Chicago cop, this is going to be great. This problem's going to be solved. So I go up to the Chicago cop, a guy named Montgomery. And I say, and I know his name now because it's on a bunch of court papers. And I say, officer, I'm glad to see you. I'll talk to you. And he says, I need to see your ID. That's not what I want to hear. I said, very clear, I said, officer, I am happy to identify myself, but I do not want to give you my ID. He says, give me your ID or I'm going to arrest you. I said, officer, I'm not required to give you my ID. He says, state law, you have to give me your ID. I'm not required to give you my ID. I'm happy to identify myself. I should have just said my name right then and there. I'm happy to identify myself, but I don't want to give you my ID, and I'm not required to by law. You know, this is still America. You don't have to carry your papers, right? Show me your papers. That's not how it works here. Still. And the Supreme Court is pretty solid about that. So I realize there's a problem. I grab my phone, my iPhone out of my pocket, because I've got my attorney on speed dial. And I think he's here, Tom Brekka. I'm going to call the Thomas More Society to see, because if they can talk to the police, a lot of times that this is not the first time I've been in this situation with an officer demanding my ID. We've been through this before. I know what you do. You get the attorneys on the phone. They'll often, police will let, you know, you hand them the phone, talk to them, explain to them that's not the law, what the problem is. And then everything is solved. Dissipate the tension of the situation. Instead, what happened was that the one security guard who wanted my ID grabbed my arm, whipped the phone out of my hand, just as the police officer was pulling my other arm back, putting my wrist behind me and telling me, "You're under arrest." And I tried to reach for my wallet. I said, "Hey, look, I'll give you my ID then, you know. Because if it's a choice between being thrown in jail and having to wait until he gives my ID back, I'll just give him my ID. You know, that'll be fine." So, no, he says, "I need help here. He's resisting." So they grabbed my arms, pulled my arms behind my back, clapped on these handcuffs super tight, pulled the GoPro camera off my belt, and took me into a holding cell inside a Navy pier. Now, while I was in there, I realized, you know, I've got this camera with footage on it that proves I was given permission to walk onto this pier. It also shows that I never entered any area that said it was restricted, public's not allowed, no trespassing. This is completely exculpatory evidence, evidence that shows that they have no business holding me and that I've done absolutely nothing wrong. So I asked the officer, I said, "Hey, look, I need to turn my camera off because it's running on a loop. And if it sits there, it's going to loop over and record over what just happened, which was nothing. We can't have that." And this guy says to me, "If Navy Pier wants it erased, it'll be erased." I said, "Well, that would be destroying evidence." He didn't like hearing that. So I sat back on the chair, and at this point, I heard this clickety-click-click as the handcuffs tightened around my wrists. I didn't even know if they were handcuffs, because a lot of times on TV you see them using those zip ties. These were real metal handcuffs, and they clicked down when I leaned on them, and I started losing the feeling in my fingertips. So I was begging him to loosen the handcuffs. He said, "Oh, no, you were resistant. You were resistant. I'm not going to." So he tries to get a couple of other cops to come and help him. And meanwhile, comes back with a trespass statement saying, "I'm not allowed to ever go back on Navy Pier again for the rest of my life, this place I've been visiting my whole life, because of trespassing," even though I was leaving the pier when they arrested me. Long story short, I finally got those cuffs loosened by the two police officers who came to take me to jail. And I thought it was odd that they took all of my stuff, my coat, my pencil. I always use a mechanical pencil. My son gave it to me. It's dear to me. My keys, everything else they took, but they left my phone and my GoPro camera behind with Officer Montgomery. I said, what about my phone and my camera? "Oh, Officer Montgomery will bring those in." Okay, it seems weird. So they took me to the paddy wagon. And I don't know if it's on purpose or just part of procedure, but every time, this was actually my first time in a paddy wagon. And a lot of people are surprised to hear that. They think, a pro-life activist, you know, you must be getting arrested so often. They've got a cell with your name on it. This was my first arrest for pro-life activism. And so I sat in that paddy wagon waiting and waiting and waiting and wondering if my parents or who were at the protest or any of my staff knew where I was. I tried to call out to my assistant as I was getting arrested. And he came over and was able to shoot a little bit of footage. But where are they now? They finally get me to the 18th District Police Department. I later found out that this was the same district where my father was booked and jailed the very first time that he was arrested as a pro-life activist way back in the 70s. I thought that was a pretty cool coincidence. So I sit in one cell for about an hour, and you know, I finally got to use a bathroom there. It's a really embarrassing bathroom because it's a cell with just everybody walking around, and they have this sort of screen you can use, and, you know, got relief there. I was still starving. And it was funny. My first thought when he arrested me wasn't, you know, oh, glorious victory, I can stand up for the unborn babies with my arrest, you know, or oh no, it was, I'm going to miss the soccer match. I had plans to go to my brother's house after the protest and watch a friendly match between the USA and Mexico. They're our biggest rivals, and we used to always beat them. So that was my very first thought, and we were going to have dinner at his house, so I'm really, really hungry now. Eventually, I wind up in, after being fingerprinted and all of that, I wind up in this very small cell. It's got nothing but a concrete bench at the back and this sort of unit. It's like a drinking fountain unit, but it's also a toilet. And it's not like the classic, you know, romantic jail with bars you can grab, you know, and rattle your tin can against. It's just a big metal door with a tiny window with the sort of ribbing from the, reinforced glass. And there was a tiny little, like, 3/4 inch gap, and I could put my face right up against the door and see all the way down the hall and hear a little bit what was going on and the conversations down there. And every time someone came down the hall, I was hoping it was to release me. Mostly they were coming down the hall because there was a drunk guy in the cell across the hall. There were about 12 cells down this hallway. And they would come up to him and try to wake him up because he needed to have his blood tested, I guess for his blood alcohol level or something. And I was really troubled by the way the police were talking about this guy. I can't repeat any of it to you today because this is a polite audience and there are young people. But really disturbing that the officers of the state were talking about a citizen, or even if he wasn't a citizen, a human being, in these sort of subhuman terms. It was really, really troubling to hear. The thing about jail, the main thing about jail, is that it is incredibly, incredibly boring. You don't have a phone. You don't have a book, a magazine. I mean, they could have any magazine. I would have just eaten it up, you know? Better Homes and Gardens, whatever it was. There was nothing there. They take your shoelaces. I don't know if trespass is really the kind of crime for which a person's accused. They despair and try to hang themselves with a shoelace. But they took my shoelaces. I don't know what I'd have done with my shoelaces if I had them. Maybe I could have, you know, done some, you know, those cat's cradle or something to just pass the time. So there's nothing to do. It was shortly after Easter, so I decided I would just start chanting. I'm a cantor at my church, and in the Byzantine Rite, we chant the entire liturgy. So there's a lot of chants to chant. So I chanted all the different Christ is risen from the dead chants. I would chant one of them for you now, but it's you know, Lenten season, so I don't want to do that. I chanted the Troparion of St. George. Our church is St. George Church. I prayed all the rosaries. I was really grateful to Pope John Paul II for adding in those extra mysteries because that padded my rosary a bit. How many rosaries can you pray during 4 hours in jail? It's a lot, my friends. I even started singing some of my favorite folk songs. I was just so darn bored. And then I started feeling a little bit guilty because, you know, here I am. I'm in jail for a righteous cause. You know, I should be feeling like St. Paul or St. Peter, you know, in one of those Bible stories. But I did not feel that way. I was peeved. And I was bored, and I was missing the soccer game. And I thought, you know, I should be offering this up for the unborn babies. And at that thought, my mind recoiled. I said, no, I'm sick of them. Look at what they've done to me. They wound me up in jail. I could go to prison for this. And I had this moment of deep resentment to the unborn children that I had been trying to protect by holding this protest in the first place. Now, many of you may think that's a funny thing to hear from a pro-life activist. Resenting unborn children? That doesn't seem right. And it's maybe a little bit embarrassing to say, but as I reflected on that feeling and reflected on that whole experience, I began to see it in a different light. You know, I grew up the oldest of 7 children. I have to remind myself sometimes with my own kids that I'm their dad and not their big brother. I'm not supposed to tease them. I'm supposed to, you know, raise them gently. So as a big brother, you know, I have a special appreciation for what our Lord says to St. Peter. St. Peter comes up to Jesus and says, how many times do I have to forgive my brother? I get that. I have a brother who's 11 months younger than me. He knows every one of my buttons, and his greatest delight as a child was to press them one after the other. Joe and I were at each other's throats all the time. St. Peter doesn't say, hey, how many times do I have to forgive my buddy? How many times do I have to forgive, you know, my neighbor or the stranger? No, he asks, how many times do I have to forgive my brother? Because the brother is the one that when he wrongs you, he wrongs you so deeply, you know? And Jesus answers, to the dismay of all older brothers, 70 times. Now, I don't know if you're a mathematician, but that's 490. So I'm tempted to kind of keep a tally, because when I get to 491, good luck, Joe. So your brother knows how to get to you. Your siblings know how to get to you because you have a very special relationship with them. And I realized that my sense of resentment for those unborn babies at that moment when I was in jail, a place I didn't want to be. See, I thought if I were ever arrested as a pro-life activist, it would be on my terms. The cops would say, you have to leave or we're going to arrest you in the middle of some event. And I'd say, then do it. You know, I'd have planned it. I didn't expect to be shockingly suddenly arrested for doing nothing when I had plans. So I was peeved. I was disappointed. I was angry at those little baby boys and girls. But I realized I've grown up with these kids. You know, as I mentioned at the little dinner for the presenters last night, unlike probably most of you, I cannot remember the first time that I saw an abortion victim photo. I was maybe 6 or 7 years old. I do remember seeing the old Jack Wilkie slides in my basement as my dad was getting things going as a pro-life activist, showing people the reality of abortion. But I've held abortion signs my whole life long. My children have too. I remember when my daughter Ada was born. Ada turned 15 yesterday. I had to miss her birthday to come out here. It's all good though. I took her out to breakfast and I gave her a present before I left for my flight. When Ada was born, I recognized a similarity between, she's got a real round little face. I recognized a sort of a similarity between her and Malachi. You guys know Malachi, baby Malachi on that sign? I'm seeing a lot of nodding heads out there. Malachi is a little baby boy who was aborted at 22 weeks. The abortion required his arms and legs to be ripped off. So there he is, this torso with the arms and legs positioned next to it. And it's a shocking image. It's a disturbing image indeed. Horrible to think of both of the violence of the abortion as well as the life that was cut out. But if you can look past the gore, if you can look past the horror of that image, you see a beautiful, beautiful face. And that face resembles the face of my daughter Ada when she was a little baby. And when I noticed that, I felt a moment of real anger. This is unfair. Why do I have to think about an abortion when I look at my beautiful, tiny little girl? She's my, let me do some math here. She's my sixth child of my eight kids. And it's funny, we've referred to the three younger ones as the little girls. And she's 15, and we call her the little girls. You know, that's not fair. That's not fair. And you know, it's not fair that anyone should have to think of an abortion when they look at their little baby. But then I thought, you know what? Somebody has to. Somebody has to look at the beautiful face of a very much loved and wanted child and think about abortion and think about the faces of those babies that no one will ever gaze at in wonder. No one will ever sing a lullaby to. And that's a euphemism. When I say lullaby for Ada, that's a euphemism for holding her down with my arm. She was very spunky, and sometimes I can only get her to sleep if I held her down like this with her under my arm. And for months, I had a sore arm and neck from holding that little kid down so she'd finally fall asleep. Even those little struggles, that little boy Malachi and other babies like him are never going to have a dad who has to figure out the special way to get this one to sleep. Because all eight of my kids had a special way that they needed to be put down to sleep when they were little kids. Nate, I would just cuddle, he'd fall asleep, put him down. Sam, I had to play this elaborate game called Tippy Tip, where I would say, Tippy Tip, and he'd say, Tippy Tip, Tippity Doo, Tippity Doo. And we would go on for a half an hour like this before he'd finally get drowsy and fall asleep. So, you know, that's the thought that I had when Ada was born, that she looks like little baby Malachi, who will never whose special way of going to sleep no one will ever think about. So the resentment that I felt for that moment, and it was really just a moment, in jail back in April 2015, was the kind of resentment you have for your siblings, people to whom you are close. And I was really encouraged to know that this is how I feel about these children. And that's what I want to share with you today, that we need to feel a special relationship with the unborn child. And the title of my talk is Blessed Are They Who Mourn. You know, when you hear my story, you might think, you know, when you think about the Beatitudes, you might think, you know, blessed are they when you are reviled and persecuted and they hurl all that is evil against you untruly for Christ's sake. You might think, blessed are they who hunger and thirst after justice. If you go through all the Beatitudes, you'll find that there's a connection to the pro-life movement in all of them. Blessed are the peacemakers. We want to make peace between the child and the mother in the womb, between the social tragedy and difficulties of unplanned pregnancy and the society that turns to abortion. There's so many ways that all the Beatitudes inform our pro-life ministry. But the one that I think is most important to me, is blessed are they who mourn, for they shall be comforted. That came back to me again last year when I was with my crew organizing a brand new display of abortion victim photos. And while I'm on the subject, let me just pause for a moment to say, please, every one of you, never again say the words graphic abortion sign or graphic abortion picture. Those words are used to undermine and disapprove of what we're doing. Say abortion victim photo, because that's what they are. Some of them are more disturbing than others. Some of them are more graphic than others. But there are many abortion victim photos that are not graphic. And my crew and I hunted many of them down. And none of them are pretty exactly. But we've got a picture of a foot. It's purple because that's the color of a very early abortion baby's foot. It's not bloody, it's just normal, just the foot. It's a foot from a baby that was aborted at 7 weeks, and the caption says, she'll never learn to walk. The point is to draw a relationship between the viewer and the child. Everyone, every parent remembers that first step that a child takes that's followed by the second step when they learn to walk. This child will never learn to walk. We have a picture of two hands. And if you look really closely, you'll see that they're so small, they're actually on the finger of a surgical glove. 10 perfect fingers. Because, again, that's the first thing you notice. Those tiny, tiny fingers, they're smaller than you can believe they could be. These tiny fingers with these itty-bitty fingernails on them. And a lot of times the fingernails are long, and one of the first things you have to do is clip the fingernails. And I remember the first time I clipped my son Nate's fingernails, and I cut his skin a little bit. Because it's hard to cut those soft little baby fingernails. And I felt so guilty. I cut that tiniest little piece of skin as I was cutting those fingernails. Nate has just landed in London now. He's almost 26 years old. I still remember that day. So you draw a connection between these parental experiences. We picked a sign of the face of a little baby boy aborted at 15 weeks. It's one of a whole series of pictures taken after an abortion in Romania. And there are many of them that are very, very gory. We picked one that had a minimum of blood that focused on the face. And one side of the sign says, remember this face. And the other side of the sign says, his only baby picture. So we have this display of signs that we take out into the public square that are attempting to draw a personal connection between the viewer and the signs. The signs don't say abortion is murder. The signs don't say end abortion. They don't talk about the abortionist. They don't talk about anybody's guilt or involvement in the issue. They simply try to make an emotional connection between the viewer and the child. And the response to this display was incredible. People took literature and stopped and read it like we've never seen before. One of my daughters, when she first saw our pamphlet that spelled out, you know, the things these children will not get to do. The one who will never learn to walk, she'll never kick her first soccer ball. She'll never walk down the aisle with her daddy. She'll never go to her first high school dance. You know, those 10 perfect fingers will never, you know, fold their hands in prayer and so forth. She actually cried. This is my hard-edged oldest daughter, who's usually cynical. She saw that pamphlet and she cried as we tried to draw that human connection. This is really about loving the unborn child. And when we think about mourning and think about the value of mourning, I think it can provide a sense of hope or even blessedness to us. I know that many of you are involved in sidewalk ministry outside of abortion facilities. The most important thing you can do as a pro-life person, if there's any way you can be present outside an abortion facility, you should be. Whether it's, you know, once a month, once a week, during the 40 Days for Life campaign. I one time did the math. If every single adult who says they're completely pro-life, that is to say someone who's opposed to abortion in all cases, that's about 20 to 25% of Americans believe that abortion is wrong in every case, should always be against the law. If every one of those people who say they believe that were to spend 1 hour per year outside an abortion facility, there would be 100 to 200 people outside every abortion facility in America during every single hour that they're open everywhere in the United States. How long could abortion last if there were 100 to 200 people praying every single time a woman goes for an abortion? We could end abortion tomorrow with that kind of conviction. But in fact, only a tiny few of those millions who say they're completely against abortion ever go out to an abortion facility. And I'm grateful that many of them are here today. When you're there, of course you're reaching out to try to save the babies. You're praying and interceding for them. You're trying to save the mothers from the horrible, tragic choice that's going to wound them so deeply that Molly talked about this woman experiencing years later. But you're also doing something else, because you may not be able to save that baby. In fact, you probably won't be able to save that baby that day. If you sidewalk counsel at a place like the Planned Parenthood in Aurora, this mega center, this abortion fortress where I sidewalk counsel and pray, it's almost impossible to talk to the women going in. Planned Parenthood built it that way with a big, huge parking lot, and they keep adding a new layer of arborvita every couple of years. The trees keep dying. I don't know if someone's salting the earth or something. The trees keep dying. They keep planting new ones. They have speakers there that blast out this horrible fusion jazz music to just kind of make it hard to hear us. It's very hard to even talk to the women, let alone guide them to the pregnancy center that's right nearby. But what I can do for every single one of those children being taken to be killed that day is I can mourn for them. I can mourn for that child. The only gift that they will receive this side of eternity is my being there, acknowledging their humanity to the society around us and to the devil who wants us to forget them. This is why abortion is the devil's tool for the 20th and 21st century. Because abortion is so fundamental. It happens in the dark. It's socially acceptable now. It destroys the relationship between mother and child. It destroys the best way we have to understand who we are as children of God, as beings created in the image of God. Because think about this. Every single person in this room, every single person in this hotel, in this city, state, country, was born from the womb of a woman. You started your life inside someone else's body. Inside someone else's body. Every woman has an organ in her body designed for one purpose only, to be the home of a child for the first 9 months of their life, the most important 9 months of their life, really, where they're knit together in secret. What is God telling us? He's telling us that we are meant for communion. We are meant to dwell within each other. We're meant to dwell with God. The connection that he wants us to have with him, the connection that he has within his Trinitarian self, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, is reflected in a profound way in the very fact of pregnancy and birth, that bond between mother and child. That's what the devil is destroying. That's what he's going after, because he doesn't want us to know who we are. That's why he deceived Eve and Adam in the first place, so we wouldn't know who we are, children of God, made for love, made for communion. So my exhortation to you is to take seriously this obligation to mourn for the unborn child. First, because it is a way to make your time outside the abortion facility always be blessed. Because even when you can't talk to anyone and someone drives by and gives you the finger, or the cops come and hassle you, if you're there mourning for those children, you are doing something profoundly important. It's something that is a gift to them, and you're really fighting back at the devil. Other ways you can do this is to participate in events like the National Day of Remembrance for Aborted Children that takes place the third Saturday of every year. We go to the burial places of these children around the country and we pray. I think it's September 8th this year. We go to other memorial markers set up in their memory and really think about what their lives would have meant. The place where I hold this in the Chicago area, there are 2,033 aborted babies buried there. Their bodies were recovered from a pathology lab in the Chicago suburbs, and they were buried in 1988. So some of them, had they been allowed to live, would be old enough now to perhaps even have children. What would their lives have been like? Who would they have been? What would they have looked like? What would their names have been? We don't know their names. We don't know their faces. But we know that God loves them, and so we love them too. As Cardinal George reminded us at one of the prayer services we held at this gravesite, we remember them in our daily prayers. I think we have to have a real realism about these children. We have to be able to look at a picture of an embryo, a funny-looking being, and see a human being. We have to be not afraid of the word fetus. Fetus is just Latin for little one. It's used as a slur against our unborn brothers and sisters, but it's really just a stage of life. We have to be unafraid to show those victim photos. Again, I asked you earlier, don't ever say graphic abortion photo. When someone says, I don't like graphic abortion photos, that kind of makes sense, at least linguistically. But when they say, I don't want to see abortion victim photos, it sounds silly. You shouldn't be showing abortion victim photos at the place where babies are victimized by abortion. It starts to look silly. It starts to sound silly because it is. Not that there isn't a time and a place. We have to be judicious. A big, huge, giant abortion sign in front of a sidewalk counselor who's trying to reach out to the woman is going to be counterproductive. She's not going to want to come up to somebody with a big, ugly sign. So there's times and places. We have to be judicious, but we have to be careful with our language, too, so that we understand clearly why it's important to show these pictures. And we need to have a kind of solidarity with the unborn child. The unborn child is extremely weak and small and lacks a personality or an identity that we can see. And in this way, I think they're a sign to us of God's very being. And for this idea, I need to credit Edmund Miller. If you were here last year, you would have heard Monica Miller speaking. Her husband, Edmund, has a deep reflection on how the unborn child shows us the nature of God, because the unborn child is valuable not because of what they can do today or what they might do tomorrow, which could be cure cancer, but could also be fly a plane into a skyscraper. We don't know what every unborn child is going to do. What they're going to do isn't relevant. What their name is, even what their sex is. We don't know these things when these children are aborted. And in this way, they are sort of pure being, right? The way that God is pure being. They're a sign to us of, that our humanity is not about what we do, what we say, how we look, who we know, but simply that we are beings created in the image of God with will, with intellect, with the ability to love. So we need to have solidarity with these unborn children. We have to recognize our own weakness in this fight and embrace it like Christ embraced the cross and be confident in the resurrection, a resurrection at which I believe we will finally get to meet them, those little unborn baby boys and girls who sometimes, at least for someone who grew up with them, can be a little bit annoying, but who nevertheless we love. So God bless you. Thank you.
Wow. All right, I've got a couple of questions here that were passed out for us. But before I do that, I just want to make an announcement that if somebody's lost their cell phone, it's at the registration desk. Okay. Okay, Eric, thank you for those incredible words. Incredible. I've done this a long time, and they brought me to tears, some of them. Thank you. Thank you so much, because it really is. This is what it's about. Okay, so here are some of the questions. And this is, they're sort of, some of them are repeats of others, so we're just going to go. As a pro-life activist, firstly, number one, how many times have you been arrested? And secondly, should a person be afraid of being arrested, getting that on your record? How does that affect you?
Yeah, good question. I've been arrested once as a pro-life activist. That was the one time. You know, the arrests that are so famous, people often assume I've been arrested again and again. Most of those arrests were taking place back in the 80s and 90s when I was in college, living a very different lifestyle, let's say. I kind of came back to a Catholic faith in my early 30s. So I wasn't there when the rescues were happening and all those arrests were taking place. And I had the opportunity to be arrested any number of times where the police said, you know, take the signs down or we're going to arrest you. I remember one time in suburb of Mundelein, Illinois, where there happens to be a seminary. The cops came up. We were there for one of our, what we call Face the Truth tours. We had the victim photos on display. And they even got the police chief up out of bed that morning, Saturday morning, his day off. He came out, and we wrangled with him, and we got the lawyers on the phone and went back and forth. And then finally, he said, look, no more talking. Take the signs down, or I'm going to start arresting you, starting with you. Which I appreciated, because I always tell people when they're like, are we going to get arrested? I said, you know what? I'm going to get arrested first. You'll see that, and then you can run. I said, okay, we'll take down the signs. It was the first day of our tour. I didn't need my signs impounded. I didn't need, you know, 80 people to have to be bailed out of jail. This is going to disrupt the whole thing. We are not here to make a sign and symbol. We are here to show abortion to this community and the next community and the community after that. It's more important for us to be able to go to the next village and then the town after that and the rest of the week that we had planned. So we agreed to put our signs down and instead sue them, which we did. And they let us hold. We came back about a month or two later, and we held another Truth Day in Mundelein. Three different, instead of one location, we had three locations that day. That's what you get. And one of those locations was right across from a Catholic high school. So it was really a great opportunity to show the young people the reality of abortion. So choosing not to get arrested actually was helpful. Should you be afraid of getting arrested? I don't think so, honestly. I mean, it does happen, and it can happen unexpectedly. There's a pro-life activist named John Ryan who was arrested a little while ago in St. Louis for doing nothing. And he was arrested because he had a long history of pro-life activism. He'd been arrested several times in the 80s. They singled him out because they wanted to try to pass a bubble zone or buffer zone law. So the first thing they had to do was arrest somebody for doing something violent or threatening violence. And then they could go to the city council and pass this bubble zone law. John was doing nothing but counseling women as they went into the facility. Someone from Planned Parenthood called the police and said he had entered the clinic and said there was a bomb. None of it's true, and the video shows that none of it's true. They arrested him anyway. His case is ongoing. They later downgraded the charges from felony to misdemeanor, just trespass or something. He's going to get off, I'm sure. But the whole purpose of that was to try to pass a law. So things like that do happen, but they are extremely rare. For the most part, you're not even going to see the police. But if you do, our advice, and some of my attorneys are here, our advice is to obey the police now and grieve later. Obey now, grieve later. Because once you get caught up in a case, you then have to win it, and then you can sue them after that. To kind of wrap up my story, I forgot this part of it. This is sort of an important part. I was charged with trespass. I had a criminal trial. One of the security guards came and told a crazy story about taking me to the bathroom, and she was obsessed with these sandbags. I had moved a sandbag once and put it next to a sign so that this elderly woman could hold it better, and they came and told me to put the sandbag back, and this later turned into our entire crew ripping sandbags up. And they had to bring in an engineer or something. It was a crazy story. The judge could see that it was crazy. They showed the video of me walking and doing nothing because the cameras from Navy Pier showed I did nothing wrong. And when the state was finished with their case, the judge said to my attorneys, would you like to put on your case? And the attorney said, yes, we would, and turned to their computer to think of what the next thing was. And the judge says, not guilty. And my attorneys didn't even hear him. I said, hey, I think he just said not guilty. He said, excuse me, Judge, not guilty. He didn't even have to hear our case. We didn't have to put on a case. It was that bad. And then I filed a lawsuit against all these entities, MPEA, NPI, the police officer. And all I can say is that we settled with Navy Pier for an undisclosed amount. And I'm still suing the cop. Thanks. I can't tell you the amount, but I can tell you that last year I bought a very nice guitar. I'm still suing the police officer, and next week we are putting in a motion for summary judgment. So say a prayer that that goes well, because that's another part of this. The cops can't just go arresting you because a security guard tells them to.
Any other questions?
One more question.
What I'm going to say is we do have a couple more questions, but we're out of time. So you all know that I have a radio program called From the Median. We are going to get Eric back on the radio program, and I'm going to ask him the rest of the questions. So how does that work?
Sounds great.
Okay, so that's what we do. We'll let you know.